Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. If you didn't hear it already, be sure to go back and check out our previous podcast about the Oscar ceremony, which we talked about with Josh, and then James and I discussed 12 Years a Slave. The two halves of the podcast have drastically different tones, but they're both good.
If you haven't found out who won yet, this is the easiest way to find out all your Oscar winners.
and early,
I think we say three of them over an hour.
Early next week, we're gonna do a podcast about True Detective, and the 8 episodes of it. So yeah, be sure to get caught up on that before the finale this week. And if you're not, stay off social media for approximately 24 hours. But yeah, that's not what we're talking about today. So we'll just get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
What about nonstop, though, James?
What about nonstop, indeed? Right. Taken to the air. yeah, nonstop.
Yep.
A movie you're very excited about.
I would say I was, yeah. I was excited.
Yeah, so Liam Neeson is in the sky.
Good, I'm in. Where do I buy my ticket?
He's an air marshal. Yeah. So, just to open up the line of questioning for you, I believe post Phantom Menace, you said Liam Neeson should stop being Qui-Gon Jinn for the rest of his career and should do something different.
Yeah.
Is his, you know, extended Taken series and movies that aren't called Taken enough of a departure from Qui-Gon for you to get behind?
Yeah, because he's not playing characters that, or at least in the movies that I feel like we would consider part of the Taken oeuvre, if you will. he's not playing characters that really teach anybody anything. Like, Taken is his least confused character. I forget his character's name, because why would I remember his fucking character's name in Taken? But he's not necessarily in control, but he knows what he's doing in Taken. Whereas, you know, stuff like Unknown, The Gray, and Nonstop, there's a lot more confusion involved. And I think it's good. I think it's great. And yes, he did kind of stop playing Qui-Gon. I'm sure he's got that locked in, and he can go back to it at any time. You know, it's like Larry Bird shooting a jump three-pointer. He can do it with classy shoes on now. but yeah, it's just sort of, yeah, it's definitely different.
Do you find him a significantly different action star than the other action stars around right now?
Oh, I don't know. Who are we calling a viable action star today? Statham, I assume?
Yeah.
Statham, huge Statham fan over here.
Yep.
I think you know this. I do think there is a difference. Part of it is an age thing, and the fact that, you know, Liam Neeson is imposing. He's a large man, and I'm very confident he could beat the shit out of me. But I think the thing that makes him and Statham different, if only from a physical standpoint, is Statham's mobility. But I think the big difference between Liam Neeson and other action stars, if we're staying on the Statham thing, is just the roles he selects. I feel like Liam Neeson, even in his action movies that don't, like the action movies that he's being in, I feel like there's something really personal about them to him. Whereas I feel like Statham knows what he's doing, and he's so confident that what he's doing is good for him, and he doesn't care. Like, he's very upfront about how he doesn't think he's a great actor. He's just sort of good at this thing, and I love that about Jason Statham. Whereas I feel like Liam Neeson, he's trying to learn something about himself in these roles while also having fun on set, you know?
Yeah.
Which is weird. Like, it's sort of this, cause Nonstop is, gets pretty ludicrous, but I don't think it's hard to figure out why Liam Neeson was like, yes, I will be in this film, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, because Statham could do this movie. Like, it's not as though this has
Statham
to be.
Statham could do this movie, and I would love it.
Yeah. Obviously, Statham but could do anything, and you'd love it.
Well, no, I don't, it's not like I love all of Statham's movies. I see them all, which I feel like is a big enough statement. But, yeah, I feel like it, with Statham, I feel like it would be a slightly... either slightly worse, or the things that... let's say the third act would hit a lot less, like immediate would be like, this is bullshit. Whereas with Liam Neeson, you'll at least give it a second, you know?
Yeah.
He sort of has this gravitas to him, you know, which is a word everybody uses to describe Liam Neeson in action films, but it's true.
Yeah.
He was Aslan, you know, like he's just got the voice to make you listen to him.
Yeah. No, I've just been thinking so much about his, you know, he is older, he's taller. You don't really think of him as jacked. Like, I'm sure he's in.
Yeah, he's like, he's a healthy man.
A very powerful individual. And it's, you know, always just about him being clever in these little small hand-to-hand fights and mm-hmm. him kind of knowing more things.
Yeah, it's like knowing to go for the throat.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And his leadership skills are possibly the most important thing in The Gray, you know, as far as survival.
Right. And yeah, it's just these kind of ridiculous action movies that get so much more weirdly grounded with him in them. And
yeah.
I know we talked about this a bit on The Gray podcast, a podcast that I think we were both surprised by how much we, you know, took from the Arctic Survival, someone just killing wolves.
Yeah, well, that's
six movie.
That's why we did that podcast in August, despite that movie being released in January. It's like when I finally got around to watching it, I was like, oh, James, we should do a podcast on this. Yeah.
Yeah, and I wonder if part of that seriousness that people can attribute to Liam Neeson, no matter what the situation is, from the personal story about his, you know, his wife dying really late in his life, and I don't know, there's just kind of this sense of tragedy about him all the time, and in this movie, he had a daughter who died when she was 8 from cancer, and has a little girl on the plane that he kind of feels the need to protect. Just something, you know, a lot of different action people could do this movie and it would just be a lot different, and I think this is a nice fit for him. It's a bit more of a mental action movie, like I guess a bit more of a thriller, to use your favorite word, than, you know, other plane hijack. Like, it's not Die Hard 2, it's a little bit more about the situation on the plane and the kind of social experiment of what happens when a bunch of things go terribly wrong and you don't really know who to trust. So,
well, I mean, if we're just sort of looking back at Neeson's career post his wife's death, Natasha Richardson died in March 2009, I think, of a ski accident. And it's she just hit her head a weird way and she was fine for a bit and then had to go to the hospital hours later and then died. Taken was filmed before. Taken was already released when Natasha Richardson died. But like since then, if we're looking at his action movies, like Unknown is not a good movie in any way. I really didn't like it. Same director as Nonstop, but a piece of garbage film. The core idea at the beginning of the movie is you wake up one day and everything you thought you knew about yourself is changed entirely. And easy to see why Liam Neeson would sign on for it. The Gray is about finding out why you would stay alive when the person you love the most dies. I mean, that's even significantly less vague. And Nonstop, I think a big part of it, part of the core of the movie is it's about helplessness and specifically the guilt of not being able to help your loved ones in any way. And
being the one that survived.
Yeah. Also that. Yeah. And it's just sort of like, it's just this thing that takes away the person you love the most and there's nothing you can do about it. And and it's, I mean, these are all movies with the exception of Unknown that I think are very enjoyable for people that know nothing about Liam Neeson's personal life. But the more you know about Liam Neeson, the more interesting the movie gets. You know? And yeah, I think that is, he has this weird sort of, level of auteurship as an action star that I think is, I don't know if it's unprecedented. I have to put more thought into it, but it's fascinating.
Yeah, and I was just thinking that's kind of what got me to that first line of questioning. It's him kind of having this throughout a bunch of different movies, and movies that you can see be made with someone else, but kind of has this feel to it with him.
Yeah, and it's not like there's nothing in between those movies. Like, I mean, The A-Team is just sort of like a fun action movie. it's so crazy.
It does have a parachuting tank.
It's so great. But I think those are the ones where... these ones that I've talked about at great length are the ones where he's like, yeah, I can get something out of this. And he's also very upfront in interviews talking about how I think he said in an interview leading up to Nonstop's release, it's not surprising, but definitively he would talk about the fact that he's not over his wife's death. And that's not surprising, but the fact that he would talk about it in an interview is interesting to me. Surprising as well.
From the angle of Nonstop, he's an older man and his young daughter died. So the kind of survivor's guilt anger.
Yeah.
I should have been clearly the one I should have been the one to die first. She should have buried me, not the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. And he was probably, I think, 12 years or something older than his wife. That's part of it as well. Yeah,
that's what I mean. He's the older one, and males tend to die first anyhow. So I think that's the kind of survivor's guilt angle of him making it much longer than his daughter did in life in this movie plays into that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, okay. So let's talk about this movie.
Now that we got the fun stuff out of the way.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. As I said, it's kind of it's not Die Hard 2. It's a bit more of a movie where you hear the plot.
Although they do try and get a John McClane type character in there. The bald New York cop.
New York cop.
That has questionable views about gay people.
In California.
I assume once he gets off that stretcher, he makes fists with his toes to get down from his fear of flying.
Even the line from the trailer is, we're midway across the Atlantic, how do you kill someone in a crowded plane and get away with it? Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the question going into this. It's if your goal is not to just crash this plane, like, part of my curiosity was, I know people are going to die in this movie. Maybe one of them is a public fight near the end of the movie, now that we've established who all the bad guys and good guys are. But what are all those 20-minute kills that there needs to be at least three of in a, even a 90-minute movie, you would think?
Yeah, for sure. I don't think anybody was sad to see the guy with the douchiest haircut of all time go. So I think that's part of it, is that you just get the first guy to be the person that obviously nobody cares about. Get the guy from Hell on Wheels and kill him, and nobody will care.
The dirty air marshal doing a Joey Greco impression.
Yeah, exactly. Wannabe Joey Greco, which is possibly the only thing worse than being Joey Greco.
No better, whoever you are, that's not Joey Greco. Yeah, but I do like the, I kind of like that question of it, of, how he's going to even kill anybody on this plane.
Yeah.
And I like the kind of claustrophobic disaster setting. I like the whole social angle of when people start losing trust, when it, when scared people kind of take things into their own hands. Mm-hmm. And obviously being stuck on a plane, and not even a plane the size of Air Force One, but kind of just coach flight deck.
Yeah, exactly.
First class, and that's all there is.
Yeah, that was one of the things we talked about. We saw this movie together, and before we got into the theater, basically, we were talking about whether or not it would just be like Air Force One, and basically the conclusion we came to is that there's going to be way less room on this plane and fewer environments for them to play around with, and I think that both increased our level of excitement.
Yeah, and there's just no, like, this movie's barely about hiding at all. Air Force One.
Yeah, it would. That was Die Hard on a plane. 100%. Yeah,
exactly. They had different floors to hide on and different rooms, whereas the only real hiding was you know, smoking cigarettes in the bathroom. Yeah.
Don't worry. And, just cover things up with duct tape and it's all good.
And
cigarette smell doesn't get around.
No, not at all. And the other thing, even similar, would be kind of watching the cameras to see when people are texting.
Yeah.
And of course, the turbulence wouldn't allow that to happen. So Liam Neeson had to do it himself.
Yep.
Yeah. But yeah, this is our second Scoot McNeary, Lupita Nyong'o cast. And
of the week.
in a row.
Yeah.
So I was not as aware of Scoot McNeary as you are, or as other people seem to have been.
Are other people aware?
Yeah. Okay. A lot. Just some light message board reading I've been doing. Some people have said...
You haven't been hitting the board hards on
not the board. Not hard, nonstop. But they've been saying, like, once I saw him and the fact that they were trying to pass him off as such a small character, this guy's getting too big. And I know he's not an A-list superstar at this point.
But he's the level that he could conceivably be the villain in Nonstop.
Exactly. And yeah. assuming his career is on the upswing, too. Like, he's going to have... larger stuff, not directly because of this, but because of Argo and because of some other things he's doing, and people seem to really like him and everything he does.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that's just going to be a good character actor, and he's going to be fine for the next 10-15 years, and then he might kind of disappear because that tends to happen to these characters, but he's going to have a good run before he does. Yeah,
and
he's kind of like a lesser version of Ben Mendelsohn of what he's got going on right now.
Yeah. And I don't think he's peaked yet, so. You're ready to hear the word Scoot more than you do.
that was one thing about the movie. I think I agreed with those people on the message boards. It was like, once I saw Scoot McNeary, I didn't know he was in this movie. I probably wouldn't have been able to tell you his name when I saw his face. But once I saw that guy, I was like, oh, yeah, he's the villain.
Yeah.
And although I did go into the movie thinking that Corey Stoll, who's the John McClane cop guy, because he's big enough that he could also be the villain of Nonstop. And I like him a lot, so I think I could have going in, you know, by the 10-minute mark of the movie, I feel like I was probably a 50-50 split between Corey Stoll and Scoot McNary's characters.
Yeah, and Corey Stoll, I mean, maybe not in importance, but in screen time, probably had a bigger role than the villain.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We find out so late who it is, right? This is such a murder mystery kind of whodunit thing that Corey Stoll is an active member of the screenplay for a while before we reveal our villain.
Yeah. And I love Corey Stoll. I'm just happy he wasn't the villain just because I enjoy him. I like having him around. Okay. Because I mean, to the listeners, he was Hemingway in Midnight in Paris, and he is Peter Russo in House of Cards, and is great in for drastically different reasons in both.
Yeah, I haven't seen House of Cards, but I can't imagine he's doing the Hemingway thing the whole time.
Who wants to fight? Although he is kind of a drunk. Sorry, not kind of. You would like him in House of Cards, despite the fact that you would hate House of Cards.
People tell me I would like House of Cards.
You would not like House of Cards.
Okay, well, at least
you would react to House of Cards playing on a TV screen around you like Julianne Moore would react to the end of a conversation with Liam Neeson. You would walk out of the room while saying, ugh.
She didn't do it. She wasn't the bad guy.
I know. Which also makes me happy.
Yeah. Speaking of Corey Stoll and New York City cops...
Yeah.
A lot of 9/11 action going on in this movie.
Yeah.
I thought a plane hijacking movie was going to be about 9/11.
Yeah, they never actually say 9/11, right? I mean, it's obvious that they're talking... I'm not trying to say that they're not talking about 9/11, but I feel like they talk about it explicitly without saying 9/11.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, yeah, they say 3,000 people died that day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you're okay, you might be right. They might not have ever said the words 9/11, but... Yeah.
I mean, it's obvious that they are talking. Nobody would deny it, but it was kind of interesting. I don't know.
Yeah,
at least they. I mean, this is sort of that's the thing that I kind of like about this movie. Even though I think we could agree, it tries a little too hard at the end to sort of inject meaning into itself that doesn't totally fit.
I that that's kind of my biggest problem with this movie.
Yeah, and I think it's probably everybody's biggest problem that likes the movie with it. There's this podcast called How Did This Get Made? They did an episode. It's basically there to make fun of movies that, like, how did they get made? They did an episode about Winter's Tale, and Paul Scheer is talking about how he felt like that movie deserved a participation medal for everybody trying, but it just failing. And that's how I feel about the ending of Nonstop. Like, there's a thought process there, and there's an attempt to do something. It just doesn't work, you know? The rest of the movie, I think, is very good and very enjoyable. It was so intense that the 12-year-old sitting in front of us had to go outside for a smoke after the movie was over, which is a true baffling story. But yeah, no, the 9/11 stuff doesn't totally work. Although I think the idea is interesting, you know, to try and make it about that. It just didn't come together. You know?
Yeah, it's just, I mean, airline hijacking was a concept before 9/11. I mean, when I look back, it seems like a plane got hijacked every week in the 1970s. No one seemed to care about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, you know, it was around before 9/11, but it's just impossible to do anything involving violence in an airplane without the idea of 9/11 coming up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
They're so closely associated, rightfully so, and they're going to be for, you know, beyond my lifetime, for sure. So, yeah, I'm fine with it being addressed. It just seemed really kind of ham-fisted. Like,
oh, yeah.
The fact that that was their motivation, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Not that this was just involved with the movie, but the bad guys were soldiers who aren't impressed by post 9/11 security.
Yeah, it's that his dad died. Scoot McNairy's dad died in 9/11, and both him and the Matthew Lillard of the situation went to fight in the Iraq War because of 9/11.
Right,
yeah.
And then I get that. They convince the world that one of the air marshals is a bad person.
Yeah.
And that increases airport security, and therefore their war was justified in their dad's death.
Sure.
Yeah. That's the thing.
I think
how long that sentence was proves what one problem I had with this movie.
I think his general problem was that there weren't enough air marshals in 9/11 and that they let the American people down, and which led to further letdowns with the war.
Yeah, I guess for me it's...
I'm just trying to explain what the movie tells you.
I know. It just seems weird to villainize the step that they have taken to make flights more secure. Like, they made both of these air marshals look like horrible people.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, Joey Greco already looked like a horrible person. There was no coming back from that.
Yeah, exactly.
I did like the bomb and the cocaine briefcase.
Oh, that was great.
Yeah, I was very pleased with that one.
I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, him just moving coke in the first place was interesting, and then it kind of slipped my mind for a bit. And then the bomb being inside that, I thought was a nice little move on the screenwriter's behalf.
Yep.
What did you think of the blow dart through the bathroom door into the cockpit move?
I don't know. I guess good on you. Killers? I don't know. Sure, whatever works. I don't know. It's one of those things that I just like, I just won't think about that. It happened. Okay. It's fine.
And I guess maybe the other one that fits in that category is Liam Neeson taking Scoot through the aisle and allowing him to pocket that guy's the phone in that guy's jacket pocket.
Yep.
I guess that's my other
edge. I mean, there's other things like Liam Neeson never even for a second pays attention to the guy that's clearly shooting video the whole time on his cell phone.
Even when there's a horrible shot where it's the scene where everyone has their hands on the seat in front of them, and then you look and you just see the back of a phone. You're like, no, that's not how that works at all. You should be much more concerned about this than you are.
Yeah, he's really, really observant, except for people that are shooting video of him at that moment. You know?
Except people who are disobeying the only rule he's just laid down.
Yeah. Maybe that's just a problem with Liam Neeson, and that's why he's so believable in all these roles. He just has like camera blindness, and he's never conscious of the fact that he's on set once the camera starts rolling.
that's how the gravitas we were discussing earlier comes in. He is certain this is real life.
He has camera blindness.
People are in danger unless he does what he needs to do.
Yep.
And what he needs to do is just kick ass and be sad about his personal life.
Yeah.
And also be an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Classic late career Liam Neeson move.
Yeah.
You have anything else about Nonstop?
Thomas Wayne was in it.
True.
I really enjoyed this movie. I thought it was really intense. And I thought even as the action got crazier, I was pretty invested, and I was really interested. The person, did you see the person sitting next to me when we saw this?
Yes, but I don't know what you mean.
Okay, well, like during the climax of the movie, as the camera, she was like rocking back and forth in her chair, like she was very invested in this film, and I found that really interesting because I don't see that a lot. Even though in movies like this, I'm prone to kind of look around a bit to see how people are reacting. But yeah, no, she was like really into the movie. And I feel like if I was a more emotional person, I would have been as well.
yeah.
And I thought it was like a really well executed action movie. And that's the type of movie I will always be happy to see. And thanks again, Liam Neeson, for seemingly providing that for me every couple of years.
Yeah. The other thing that we talked about in the lead up to this movie, or that I brought up, was texting on screen.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to talk about that.
Yeah. Well, yes, as we said, we saw this movie together, and obviously just by the trailers, it was clear that there was going to be a lot of texting in this movie, because yeah, it's the first one I can think of that more of the communication between the villain and the hero is done through text message.
Yeah.
Than not. Yep. Because there's definitely movies where you can see it happen often, but the fact that the majority was done through text, I think, was a first.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was very curious as to kind of how they were going to show that, because it's kind of a new technology, and I mean, relative to cinema, it's a newer technology. And I still think it's something people are trying to figure out how to depict on screen. And scripts like this show that there's definitely a place for texting, you know, in movies, not in the theater, but on the screen. And yeah, it's just something people are still trying to figure out how to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about Ghost Protocol, the latest Mission Impossible one.
I thought we agreed to call it Ghost Protocruise.
Ghost Protocruise. Hoodie Protocruise. it had one of my least favorite uses of texting in a movie.
I don't even remember it. I totally scrapped that movie from my brain after I saw it.
Okay. Well, for a movie franchise that is about being very stealth and coy and code words and masks and disguises, there's a scene very early on where someone gets a text, one of our good guys gets a text, and it's a picture of a woman's face, and under it just says "assassin" in big, big capital letters.
I do. That's right at the beginning, right?
Yeah, very okay. Close to the beginning.
I do remember that, though.
It's one of the first kills, I believe, maybe even the first.
Yeah, yeah, it's the Josh Holloway guy from Lost, right?
Yeah, and the blonde woman.
Yeah,
yeah. Terrible, like egregious. I hated that part so much, and especially because Mission Impossible, you know, maybe not so much the recent ones, but it was about being very stealth and coy and kind of a quieter, slower thing, and you know, again, false identities and things like that. I didn't love Ghost Protocol, but I hated that moment of it. Mm-hmm. Because that's just not how they would do things. But it's something that, you know, people would text now. People in that job would do a lot of texting, you would assume, because mm-hmm. it's a very private, quick, quiet way to communicate with people.
Mm-hmm.
But you wouldn't have a picture of someone's face and say assassin.
Yeah.
One word for assassin. You would do a lot of things differently, I assume.
After we're done this podcasting, to send you a text message with a picture of Scoot McNairy that just says hijacker.
Please do that. And yeah, so it's something that movies are kind of figuring out. And so legitimately, one of my concerns going into this movie is, how are they going to depict all this texting?
Yeah.
Without it being boring, without it being hard to read, without it being visually distracting. And I thought they did it well. Very rarely do you actually see the screen of his phone. You kind of see little text bubbles coming up on the screen of the film.
Yeah, I think we see the just sort of in the setup, we see the screen of his phone, and then they just sort of transition pretty quickly into just it being on screen and that being okay.
Yeah, it's established that, you know, these are on his phone. And there was a, you know, kind of a clever little funny moment, I thought, when his phone gets damaged and he's continued to reading text message, and now those text bubbles the way this phone's...
Yeah, they're cracked.
Yeah, the way that the phone screen is cracked. And to the point where the villain was texting some profanity, and those happened to be covered by the crack, so you couldn't read the F word, but you knew it was there. So yeah, I did like this movie, but I will say it is the most interesting use of texting on screen I have ever seen. So
yeah,
put that blurb on the case for sure.
If you were Peter Travers, they would. yeah, no, and I mean, just going to what you're talking about the way texting has changed, or texting in movies has changed. We talked about this as well. The first thing I could think of, or the oldest thing that I could think of that featured text messaging, was the 2004 classic Cinderella Story. And I mean, that's a movie about, I mean, it's a Hilary Duff movie. It's a movie about teenagers in high school. And, you know, just the generation that was probably the first to adopt texting as a thing that was normal. And so it makes sense that it would be in that film. And I mean, it was just, from what I recall, shots of the actual, you know, cheap old Nokia phones with those block with the block text. And and you talked about how it's used in Sex Drive as well, which I haven't seen, but I assume is another movie targeted to the youth market. And I brought up House of Cards earlier in this podcast, but House of Cards is sort of the first movie that I think is first product that I think is targeted directly at adults that is sort of using text messaging and having it be an important part of the plot. And I think that's just sort of how the communication technology has transitioned over the years, from like 2004 to 2013 when House of Cards transitions. It goes from being a thing that only teenagers would do to being a thing that the House Majority Whip would do, you know. And I think nonstop release. And what
we're believably so. We're much past the phase of early adopters.
It's more now at this point. It's more believable to see somebody text in a movie where people have a lot going on, like something like House of Cards. It's more believable to see them text than it is to see him call Zoe Barnes or something, you know?
Yeah. And that's just kind of where technology is now.
Yep. Exactly.
I have nothing more to say about nonstop or on-screen texting.
Well, then I think we're done, James, because that's what we're talking about here. You didn't want to mention the two killers thing?
What about them?
That was the thing about nonstop that I did not expect, was the scream thing. And I don't know why I never expect it, because I feel like I should know, but I felt like that would be an element you would enjoy.
Yeah, I liked it. I was kind of suspicious of it. I figured when they were watching everyone text that we were getting away from the solo.
So, yeah. Fair enough.
So yeah, two people didn't surprise me. And I've seen Scream 1,000 times more than you have. So. Yeah.
Well, and I think that's sort of... We approach these movies, at least now, I think we approach these mystery movies in a different way. I'm always... and this is for every movie. I'm always looking for what the movie's about. Like, that's the real mystery to me in every movie. It's like, oh, it's about failure and guilt. You know, like that's what I was waiting for. And I feel like you would be more interested in the murder mystery aspect of it, right?
Yes. Absolutely. As the person who read the whole plot synopsis for Safe House because I want to know. Oh, not Safe House. Safe Haven.
Yeah.
Because I want to know the killer was. You wouldn't even put those 2 minutes aside. So, yes, I'm much bigger on that than you.
All right. Thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about another murder mystery, True Detective.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.